When they were alone, Fenring said with a crafty smile, "It was either that or kill the bastard, and we didn't dare risk that." An hour later, through an unfortunate series of events, Emperor Elrud IX was reduced to ashes in the Imperial Crematorium, and his remains were misplaced. A court orderly and two medical attendants paid for the mistake with their lives. Memory and history are two sides of the same coin. In time, however, history tends to slant itself toward a favorable impression of events, while memory is doomed to preserve the worst aspects. Lady Helena Atreides, her personal journals. Father, I was not ready. The nighttime seas on Caladan were rough, and wind-driven rain pelted the windows of the castle's east tower. Another sort of storm raged within Duke Leto, though, concerned for the future of his troubled house. He had avoided this duty for too long. For months, in fact. On this isolated evening, he wanted nothing more than to sit in a fire-warmed room in the company of Romber and Kylea. Instead, he had decided at last to go through some of the old Duke's personal items. Storage chests containing his father's things were brought in and lined up along one wall. Servants had stoked up the flaming logs in the fireplace to a fine blaze, and a crock of mulled wine filled the room with the spicy scents of tarameg and a bit of expensive melange. Four small glow globes provided enough light to see by. Kylea had found a fur cloak in storage, taken it as her own, and wrapped herself just to keep warm. But it also made her look stunning. Despite the radical changes in her life, how far she had fallen from her dreams of sparkling at the imperial court, the Vernius daughter was a survivor. Through sheer force of will, Kylea seemed to bend the environment around herself, making the best of things. Despite the political drawbacks of any romance with the renegade family, Duke Leto, now ruler of his great house, found himself even more attracted to her. But he remembered his father's primary admonition. "Never marry for love, or it will bring our house down." Paulus Atreides had hammered that into his son as much as any other leadership training. Leto knew he could never shrug off the old Duke's command. It was too much a part of him. Still, he was drawn to Kylea, though thus far he hadn't found the courage to express his feelings to her. He thought she knew, even so. Kylea had a strong, logical mind. He saw it in her emerald eyes, in the curve of her cat-like mouth, in the contemplative looks she gave him when she thought he wouldn't notice. With Leto's permission, Romber searched curiously through some of the massive storage chests, looking for old wartime mementos of the friendship between Duke Paulus and Dominic Vernius. Reaching deep into one chest, he brought out an embroidered cape and unfolded it. "What's this? I never saw your father wear it." Leto studied the design and knew instantly what it was. The hawk of House Atreides embracing the Richesian lamp of knowledge. "I believe that's his wedding cloak, from when he and my mother were married." "Oh," Romber said, his voice trailing off in embarrassment. "Sorry." He folded the cape and stuffed it back into the box. Shaking his head, Leto took a deep breath. He'd known they would encounter many such memory landmines, and he would just have to endure them. "My father didn't choose to die and leave me in this position, Romber. My mother made her own choices. She could have been a valued advisor to me. Under other circumstances, I would have welcomed her assistance and wise counsel. But instead," he sighed and looked bitterly over at Kylea, As I said, she made her own choices. Only Leto and the warrior Mentat knew the truth about Helena's complicity in the murder, and it was a secret Leto vowed to carry with him to his grave. With the death of the stablemaster during interrogation, Duke Leto Atreides had fresh, bright blood on his hands. His first, but certainly not his last. Not even Romber or Kylea suspected the truth. He had sent his mother out of Castle Caladan with two of her servants, chosen by him. For her rest and well-being, Lady Helena had been taken to the eastern continent, where she would live under primitive conditions with the sisters in isolation, a retrogressive religious commune. Haughtily, but without bothering to demand explanations for her son's behavior, Helena had accepted her banishment. Though he put up a strong front, Leto privately mourned the loss of his mother, and was astounded to find himself without both parents in the space of a few months. But Helena had committed the most abhorrent act of betrayal against her own family, her own house, and he knew he could never forgive her, could never see her again. Killing her was out of the question. The thought had barely crossed his mind. She was, after all, his mother, and he was not like her. Besides, getting her out of his sight was a practical matter, for he'd been left with vast holdings to manage, and the welfare of the citizens of Caladan had priority. He needed to get down to the business of running House Atreides. From a chest of items, Romber brought out a set of old-fashioned handmade playing cards and some of the old Duke's awards, including military badges of honor, a chipped knife, and a small blood-stained banner. Leto discovered seashells, a colored scarf, an unsigned love poem, a lock of auburn hair, not Helena's color, then a lock of blonde hair, and enameled brass armbands designed for a woman, but he had no idea how to explain the items. He knew his father had taken mistresses, though Paulus had brought none of them into the castle as bound concubines. He'd merely enjoyed himself, and had no doubt showered the women with trinkets or fabrics or sweetmeats. Leto ignored those items and closed the heavy lid of the box. Duke Paulus was entitled to his own memories, his past, and his secrets. None of these mementos had any bearing on the fortunes of House Atreides. He needed to concern himself with politics and business. Thufir Hawat, other court advisers, and even Prince Romber were doing their best to guide him. But Leto felt like a newborn, having to learn everything from scratch. As the rain continued outside, Kylea poured a mug of the mulled wine and handed it to Leto, then drew two more for herself and her brother. Thoughtfully, the Duke sipped it, savoring the spicy flavor. Warmth seeped into his bones, and he smiled when he thanked her. She looked down at the odd paraphernalia and adjusted one of the gold combs in her deep copper hair. Leto noticed that her lower lip was trembling. "What is it, Kylea?" She took a deep breath and looked at her brother, then at Leto. "I'll never have a chance to go through my mother's things like this. Not from the Grand Palais. Not even the few precious items she took with her when we fled." Romber came forward and held his sister, but she continued to look at Leto. "My mother had keepsakes from the Emperor himself, treasures he gave her when she left his service. She had so many memories, so many stories left to tell me. I didn't spend enough time listening to her when she was alive." "It'll be all right," Romber said, trying to console her. "We'll make our own memories." "And we'll make them remember us," Kylea said, her voice suddenly brittle. Feeling sick inside and deeply weary, Leto rubbed the ducal signet ring on his finger. It still felt strange and heavy there. But he knew he would never remove it until some day far in the future, when he would pass it to his own son to continue the traditions of House Atreides. Outside, the storm flung more rain at the walls and windows of the ancient stone castle, while the sea shushed a foamy lullaby against the cliffs far below. Caladan felt very large and overwhelming around him, and Leto seemed incredibly small. Though it was still an inhospitable night, when the young duke exchanged smiles with Caelia and Romber, he felt warm and comfortable in his home. Leto learned of the emperor's death as he and three attendants were struggling to hang the mounted Seleucid bull's head in the dining hall. Workers used ropes and pulleys to haul the monstrous trophy onto a spot on the previously unadorned, highly polished walls. A grim Thufir Hawat stood by, watching with hands clasped behind his back. Absently, the Mentat touched the long scar on his leg, a souvenir of the time when he had rescued a much younger Paulus from another rampaging bull. This time, however, he had not acted swiftly enough. Caelia shuddered as she looked up at the ugly creature. "It's going to be hard to eat in this hall, with that thing staring down at us. I can still see the blood on its horns." Leto regarded the bull's head with an appraising eye. "I see it as a reminder that I must never let my guard down. Even a dumb animal, albeit with the interference of human conspirators, can conquer the leader of a great house of the Landsraad." He felt a shiver. "Think of that lesson, Caelia." "I'm afraid that's not a very comforting thought," she murmured, her green eyes bright with unshed tears. Blinking to clear her vision, she turned back to her own activities. With a Redulian crystal report folder open before her on the table, she devoted her energies to studying the household accounts. Using what she had learned in the Orb office on Ix, Caelia analyzed the income streams for Atreides' holdings in order to determine how work and productivity were distributed on Caladan's continents and seas. She and Leto had been discussing the matter in depth, despite their youth. The exiled Caelia Vernius had an excellent head for business, Leto was delighted to discover. "Being a good duke is not all swordplay and bullfighting," Thufir Hawat had told him once, long before all the latest troubles and challenges. "Management of little things is often a more difficult battle." For some reason, the statement had stuck in Leto's mind, and now he was discovering the wisdom of the words. When the imperial messenger marched into the dining hall, fresh off a guild highliner, he stood tall, formally dressed in scarlet and gold imperial colors. "I request an audience with Duke Leto Atreides." Leto, Romber, and Caelia all froze, remembering the horrible news they'd received the last time a crier had entered the great receiving room. Leto prayed that nothing had happened to the fugitive Dominic Vernius in his continued flight. But this official messenger wore House Carino colors, and looked as if he had delivered his announcement a dozen times already. "It is my duty to announce to all members of the great and minor houses of the Landsraad that the Padishah Emperor Elrud Carino IX has died, struck down by an extended illness in the 138th year of his reign. May history fondly remember his long rule, and may his soul find eternal peace." Leto stepped back, astounded. One of the workers almost let the mounted bull's head slip from its position on the wall, but Hawat shouted for the man to attend to his tasks. The emperor had been a fixture in the galaxy for two normal lifetimes. Elrud lived on Kaitain, surrounded by guards, protected from all threats, and heavily addicted to the geriatric spice. Leto had never considered that the old man might die someday, though in the past year or two he'd heard that Elrud had been growing increasingly frail. Leto turned to the messenger, nodded formally. Please give Crown Prince Shaddam my condolences. When is the funeral of state to be held? House Atreides will attend, of course. Not necessary, the courier replied in a crisp voice. At the request of the throne, there will only be a small private ceremony for the immediate family.
I see.
However, Shaddam Corino, soon to be crowned Padishah Emperor of the Known Universe, Shaddam the Fourth, graciously requests your appearance and your oath of fealty when he formally ascends to the Golden Lion Throne. Details of the coronation ceremony are being arranged. Leto glanced briefly at Thufir Hawat and replied,
It shall be done.
With a curt nod, the messenger said, When the protocol has been set and all schedules are made, proper word will be brought to Caladan. He bowed, sweeping his scarlet and gold cape around his arms, and spun about with a neat click of his shoes. He marched back out of the hall, bound for a flitter that would take him back to the spaceport for his trip to the next Imperial planet, where he would deliver his report again.
Well, that was good news, Romber said sourly.
His face was pale but hard. He stood quietly in the doorway, absorbing the information. If it hadn't been for the Emperor's petty jealousy and intervention, my family could have recovered from the crisis on Ix. The Landsrad would have sent help.
Elrud didn't want us to recover, Kylia said, glancing up from her accounting records. I'm just sorry my mother couldn't have lived to hear those tidings.
Leto's lips turned upward in a smile of guarded optimism.
Wait. This gives us an unexpected opportunity. Think about it.
Elrud alone bore personal animosity against House Vernius. He and your mother had their painful past, which we know to be the true reason behind his refusal to erase the blood price on your family. It was personal. Standing under the bull's head, Hawat looked closely at Leto. He listened in silence, waiting to see what his new duke would suggest.
I've tried speaking to the Landsrad Council, Leto said, but they're useless, noncommittal. They won't do anything to help us. But my distaff cousin Shaddam, he passed his tongue over the inside of his lower lip. I've only met him 3 times, but my maternal grandmother was also a child of Elrud's. I can claim blood ties. When Shaddam becomes the new emperor, I will petition him to offer you amnesty as a gesture of forgiveness. When I swear the eternal loyalty of House Atreides, I will ask him to remember the great history of House Vernius.
Why would he assent to that? Kylia wanted to know. What's the advantage for him?
It would be the right thing to do, Romber said. The fair thing.
His sister looked at him as if he'd lost his mind. He'll do it to establish the tenor of his reign, Leto said. Any new emperor wants to create an identity, show how he's different from his predecessor, not locked into old ways and old decisions. Shaddam just might be in a forgiving mood. Word has it that he was not on the best of terms with his father anyway, and he'll certainly want to show his own colors after more than a century under Elrud. Kylia threw herself into Leto's arms, and he hugged her awkwardly.
It would be so wonderful to have our freedom back, Leto, and our family holdings. Maybe there's something we can salvage from Ix after all.
Let's all keep our hopes up, Kylia, Romber said with cautious optimism. Try to envision it, and it just might happen.
We must not be afraid to ask, Leto said.
All right, Romber said. If anyone can accomplish this, it's you, my friend. Fiery with determination and optimism, Leto began to develop plans for his formal procession to Kytane.
We'll do something they won't expect, he said. Romber and I will show up for the coronation, together.
He met the Mantat advisor's alarmed gaze.
It is dangerous to bring the son of Vernius, my lord.
And precisely what they will not expect. What senses do we lack that we cannot see or hear another world all around us?
the Orange Catholic Bible.
Some considered the rocky wilderness of Forest Guard Station to be beautiful, a pristine and natural wonderland. But Baron Vladimir Harkonnen disliked being so far from enclosed buildings, sharp angles, metal, and plaz. The cold air smelled harsh and unpleasant, without the familiar fumes of industry, lubricants, and machinery. Too raw, too hostile. The Baron knew the importance of their destination, though, and entertained himself by watching the even greater discomfort exhibited by his twisted mentat. With a dirty robe and mussed hair, Peter de Vries struggled to keep up. Though his mind operated like a powerful machine, his body was pampered, scrawny, and weak.
"Everything is so primitive out here, my Baron, so filthy and cold," de Vries said, his eyes feral. "Are you certain we have to go this far? Have we no alternative other than jaunting out into the forest?"
"Some people pay dearly to visit places like this," the Baron said. "They call them resorts."
"Peter, shut your mouth and keep up with us," Raban said. They trudged up a steep hillside toward an ice-glazed and cave-parked wall of sandstone. Scowling, the mentat returned the jab with his own barbed words.
"Isn't this the place where that little boy bested you and all your hunting team, Raban?"
The Baron's nephew turned back, his thick-lidded eyes staring at de Vries, and growled,
"I'll hunt you next time if you don't watch your tongue."
"Your uncle's priceless mentat," de Vries said in a carefree tone. "But how would he possibly replace me?"
"He has a point," the Baron agreed with a chuckle. Raban muttered something to himself.
Earlier, the Baron's guards and hunting experts had combed the isolated hunting preserve, a security check so that the three men could walk alone, without their usual entourage. Carrying a Mala pistol on his hip and a heat-scattering rifle slung over his shoulder, Raban insisted that he could take care of any gaze hounds or other predators that might attack. The Baron didn't share such complete confidence in his nephew, considering the fact that a small boy had indeed outwitted him. But at least out here they could stay away from prying eyes. At the top of a bluff, the three of them rested on a ledge, then ascended another slope. Raban led the way, clawing aside thick scrub brush until they reached more exposed sandstone. There, a low crack yielded a black space between crumbling stone and the ground.
"It's down here," Raban said. "Come on."
The Baron knelt and shined a ring light into the opening of a cave.
"Follow me, Peter."
"I'm not a spelunker," the mentat replied. "Besides, I'm tired."
"You're just not physically fit enough," the Baron countered as he took a deep breath to feel his own muscles. "You need more exercise. Keep yourself in shape."
"But this isn't what you purchased me for, my Baron."
"I purchased you to do anything I tell you to do."
He bent and crawled through the opening. The tiny but powerful beam of light on his finger probed the darkness ahead. Though the Baron tried to maintain his physique in a perfect condition, he had been plagued with body aches and unexpected weakness over the past year. No one had noticed, or perhaps no one had dared mention, the fact that he'd also begun to gain weight, through no change in his diet. His skin had a thicker, pastier appearance. He had considered discussing his problem with medical experts, maybe even a Sook doctor, no matter the incredible expense of consulting one. Life, it seemed, was an endless string of problems.
"It smells like bear piss in here," de Vries complained as he squirmed through the hole.
"How would you know what bear piss smells like?" Raban said, pushing the mentat deeper inside to make room for himself.
"I've smelled you. A wild animal can't be any more rank than that."
The three men stood up inside, and the Baron illuminated a small glow globe, which floated up to shine against the near wall in the back of the low cave.
The place was rough and moss-covered, smudged with dust, showing no sign of human habitation.
"Quite a good mimetic projection, isn't it?" the Baron said. "The best work our people have done."
He reached forward with a ring-studded hand, and the image of the wall blurred, became indistinct. Rabban located a slight protrusion of rock and pushed. The entire rear wall rumbled back and fell away to reveal an access tube.
"A very special hiding place," the Baron said.
Lights flared on, illuminating a passage that led into the heart of the bluff. After they stepped inside and sealed the false wall projection behind them, De Vries looked around in amazement.
"You kept this a secret even from me, my Baron?"
"Rabban found this cave on one of his hunts. We've made some modifications using a new technology, an exciting technique. I think you will see the possibilities once I explain it all to you."
"Quite an elaborate hiding place," the Mentat agreed. "One can't be too careful about spies."
The Baron raised his hands toward the ceiling and shouted at the top of his lungs, "Damn Krauts, Prince Shaddam, to the cesspits! No, make that to the lowest depths of a filth-encrusted, lava-blasted hell grotto!"
The treasonous outburst shocked even De Vries, and the Baron chuckled.
"Here, Peter, and nowhere else on Gedi Prime, I'm not in the least worried about eavesdroppers."
He led them into a main chamber. "We three could hide here and resist an attack even from contraband atomics. No one would find us. Null entropy bins hold supplies and weapons to last forever. I have placed everything vital to House Harkonnen in here, from genealogical records to financial documents, to our blackmail material. All the nasty, fascinating details we have on the other houses." Rabban took a seat at a highly polished table and punched a button on a panel. Suddenly the walls became transparent, glowing yellow to spotlight distorted corpses, 21 in all, hanging suspended in the gaps between plaz sheets on display.
"Here's the construction team," Rabban said. "It's our special memorial to them."
"Rather pharaonic," the Baron said in a light-hearted tone.
The flesh of the corpses was discolored and bloated, the faces contorted in macabre death grimaces. The victims' expressions contained a larger measure of sad resignation than terror of impending death. Anyone building such a secret chamber for the Harkonnens must have realized they'd be doomed from the start.
"They'll be unpleasant enough to look at while they rot," the Baron said, "but we'll eventually have nice, clean skeletons to admire."
The remaining walls were layered with intricate scrollwork showing blue Harkonnen griffins as well as gross and pornographic images of human and human-animal copulation, suggestive designs, and a mechanical clock that would have offended most observers. Rabban looked at it and chuckled as the male and female parts interacted in a steady, eternal rhythm. De Vries turned around, analyzing the details and applying them to his own Mentat projection. The Baron smiled. "The room is surrounded by a shielding projection that renders an object invisible in all wavelengths. No scanner can detect this enclosure by sight, sound, heat, or even touch. We call it a no-field. Think of it. We're standing in a place that doesn't exist as far as the rest of the universe is concerned. It's the perfect spot for us to discuss our delicious plans."
"I've never heard of such a field."
"Not from the Guild, not from Ix," De Vries said.
"Who invented it?"
"You may remember our visiting researcher from Richies?"
"Chobin?" the Mentat asked, then answered his own question. "Yes, that was his name."
"He came to us in secret with a cutting-edge technique the Richesians had developed. It's a new and risky technology, but our friend Chobin saw its possibilities.
He wisely brought it to House Harkonnen for our private exploitation, provided we give him sufficient remuneration.
And we've certainly paid him enough, Rabban added.
Worth every salari, the Baron continued.
He drummed his fingers in a habitual rhythm on the tabletop.
Inside this snow-globe, not a soul can overhear us, not even a guild navigator and his damnable prescience. We've now got Chobin working on something even better for us.
Rabban impatiently slumped back in one of the seats.
Let's get on with what we need to talk about.
DeVries sat down at the self-scrubbing table, eyes bright, Mentat capabilities already whirling and grasping the implications of an invisibility technology. How it could be used.
The Baron shifted his gaze from his blunt-featured nephew to his twisted Mentat.
What an utter contrast these two are, representing the extremes of the intellectual spectrum.
Rabban and DeVries both needed constant supervision, the former because of his thick skull and short fuse, and the latter because his brilliance could be equally dangerous. Despite his obvious deficiencies, Rabban was the only Harkonnen who could possibly succeed the Baron. Certainly Abelard wasn't qualified. Other than those two bastard daughters the Bene Gesserit had forced from him, the Baron had no children of his own. He therefore had to train his nephew in the proper uses and abuses of power, so he could eventually die content with the knowledge that House Harkonnen would continue as it always had.
It would be even better, though, if the Atreides were destroyed.
Perhaps Rabban should have two Mentats to guide him, instead of the customary one. Because of his bullish nature, Rabban's rule would be especially brutal, perhaps on a scale never before seen on Gedi Prime, despite the Harkonnen's long history of torture and harsh treatment of slaves.
The Baron's expression became grim.
Down to business. Now listen, both of you. Peter, I want you to use your full Mentat abilities.
DeVries removed his small bottle of Sappho juice from a pocket inside his robe. He gulped and smacked his lips in a manner that the Baron found repulsive.
"My spies have reported very distressing information," the Baron said. "It involves Ix and some plans that the Emperor seems to have made before he died."
He drummed his fingers in time to the little ditty that always ran through his head.
"This plot has serious implications for our family's fortunes. Choam and the Guild don't even know about it."
Rabban grunted. DeVries sat up straight, awaiting more data.
"It seems that the Emperor and the Tleilaxu have made some kind of an alliance to do unorthodox and highly illegal work."
"Sligs and shit go together," Rabban said.
The Baron chuckled at the analogy.
"I've learned that our dearly departed Emperor was personally behind the takeover on Ix. He forced House Vernius to go renegade and set the Tleilaxu up so they could begin research, adapting their methods to sophisticated Ixian facilities."
"And what research is that, my Baron?" DeVries asked.
The Baron dropped his bomb. "They seek a biological method to synthesize melange. They think they can produce their own spice artificially and cheaply, thereby cutting Arrakis, us, out of the distribution channels."
Rabban snorted.
"Impossible. Nobody can do that."
But DeVries's mind spun as related information clicked into place.
"I would not underestimate the Tleilaxu, especially when combined with the facilities and technology on Ix. They'll have everything they need."
Rabban drew himself up.
"But if the Emperor can make synthetic spice, what happens to our holdings? What happens to all the spice stockpiles we've spent years building up?"
"Provided the new synthetic is cheap and effective, Harkonnen spice-based fortunes would evaporate," DeVries said stonily.
"Practically overnight."
"That's right, Peter."
The Baron slammed a ringed fist on the table.
Harvesting spice from Arrakis is incredibly expensive. If the Emperor has his own source of cheap melange, the market will collapse and House Corino will control the rest. A new monopoly held entirely in the hands of the Emperor.
Choam won't like that, Raban said with surprising insight.
De Vries suggested,
Then we will have to get this information to the Spacing Guild. We must reveal to them what the Emperor was doing, and see to it that Shaddam ceases all such investigations. Choam and the Guild won't want to lose their investment in spice production either.
But what if the new Emperor makes a treaty with them first, Peter? The Baron asked.
Choam is partially owned by House Corino. Shaddam will be out to make his mark as he begins his reign.
What if Choam presses him into giving them access to the synthetic spice at an extraordinary discount as the price of their cooperation? The Guild would love to have a cheaper, reliable supply.
They might abandon Arrakis altogether if it's too difficult.
Then we'll be the only ones left out in the cold, Raban growled. House Arcanin gets stepped on by everybody.
The Mentat's eyes fell half-closed as he droned on.
We can't even file a formal complaint with the Houses of the Landsrad. Knowledge of a spice substitute would create a feeding frenzy among the Federated families. Political alliances have shifted recently, and a number of houses wouldn't mind if our monopoly were broken. They couldn't care less if the price of melange plummets. The only ones to lose would be those who had invested heavily in secret and illegal spice stockpiles, or those who invested heavily in the expensive spice harvesting operations on Arrakis.
In other words, us again, and a few of our closest allies, the Baron said.
The Bene Gesserit and your little sweetheart among the witches would probably like an inexpensive supply, too.
The Baron glowered at his nephew. Raban merely chuckled.
So, what can we do about it?
De Vries answered without consulting the Baron.
House Harkonnen will have to take care of this by itself. We can expect no outside assistance.
Remember that we are only a quasi-fief on Arrakis, the Baron said. It was given to us on sufferance from Choam and the Emperor. And now it's like a hook on which they've hung us out to dry. We must be extremely careful.
We don't have enough military strength to fight all those enemies, Raban said.
We'll have to be subtle, De Vries said.
Subtlety?
The Baron raised his eyebrows.
All right, I'm willing to try new things.
We must disrupt this Tleilaxu research on Ix, De Vries said. Preferably destroy it.
I suggest that House Harkonnen also liquidate various assets, build up a reserve of cash, and milk our current spice production for as much hard profit as possible, because it may disappear at any moment.
The Baron looked over at Raban.
We need to squeeze. Oh, and I'll have your idiot father step up whale fur harvesting on Lankavile. We need to stuff our coffers. The upcoming battles may be quite taxing to our resources.
The Mentat wiped a red drop from his lips.
We must do this in utmost secrecy. Choam watches our financial activity carefully and would detect if we suddenly started doing something unusual. For now, it's best we don't tip our hand about the Tleilaxu research. We don't want Choam or the Guild joining forces with our new Emperor against House Harkonnen.
We've got to keep the Imperium properly dependent upon us, the Baron said.
Raban scowled, trying to wrestle his way through the implications by brute force.
But if the Tleilaxu are entrenched on Ix, how do we destroy this research without exposing it for what it is? Without giving away our own involvement and bringing all of our enemies against us.
De Vries sat back to stare at the sexual designs on the walls. The rotting corpses hung in their display cases like hideous eavesdroppers. His mind churned through Mentat calculations until finally he said,
We must have someone else fight for us, preferably without their knowledge.
Who? Rabban asked.
That's why we brought Peter here, the Baron said. We need suggestions.
Prime projection, DeVries said. House Atreides.
Rabban's mouth dropped open.
The Atreides would never fight for us.
DeVries shot back a response.
The old Duke is dead, and House Atreides is currently unstable. Paulus's successor Leto is an impetuous young pup. He has no friends in the Landsraad, and recently gave a rather embarrassing speech at the council. He went home humiliated.
The Baron waited, trying to see where his mentat was going with this.
Second data point. House Vernius, staunch ally to Atreides, has been ousted from Ix by the Tleilaxu. Dominic Vernius remains at large with a price on his head, while Shando Vernius has just been killed, based on her renegade status. House Atreides has offered sanctuary to the two children of Vernius. They're in thick with the victims of the Tleilaxu.
DeVries raised a finger to assemble the points.
Now, brash young Leto is a close friend of the exiled Prince of Ix. Duke Leto blames the Tleilaxu for the takeover of Ix, for the bounty on the mother, and for the ruined situation of their family. House Atreides values loyalty and honor far above politics, Leto said to the Landsraad. He may see it as his duty to help Romber Vernius regain his position on Ix. Who better to strike a blow for us?
The Baron now smiled as he followed the implications. So, start a war between House Atreides and the Tleilaxu. Let them tear each other apart. That way House Atreides and the synthetic spice research will both be destroyed.
Rabban was clearly having trouble envisioning this. From the intense look on his face, the Baron could see that his nephew was thinking as hard as he could, just trying to keep up.
The Mentat nodded.
If played properly, we could accomplish this in such a manner that House Harkonnen remains completely apart from the hostilities. We get what we want, and our hands stay entirely clean.
Brilliant, Peter. I'm glad I didn't execute you all those times when you were so annoying.
So am I, DeVries said.
The Baron opened one of the null entropy chambers to remove a flagon of expensive Kirana brandy. We must have a toast. Then he smiled slyly. Because I've just realized when and how we can make all this happen. His two listeners couldn't have been more attentive.
The new Duke is overwhelmed with the complexities of running his holdings. Naturally, he will attend the coronation of Shaddam IV. No great house could risk offending the new Padishah Emperor by scorning him on his greatest day.
DeVries caught on immediately.
When Duke Leto travels to the coronation, that will be our chance to strike.
On Kaitain, Rabban said.
Something more interesting than that, I suspect, DeVries said.
The Baron sipped the warm sweetness of the aged brandy.
Ah, it will be delicious revenge, and Leto won't even see it coming, won't know which direction it came from.
Rabban's eyes lit up.
We'll make him squirm, Uncle.
The Baron handed crystal snifters to his nephew and his mentat. Rabban drained his brandy in a single gulp, while DeVries simply stared at it as if performing a chemical analysis with his eyes.
Yes, Rabban, he'll squirm and squirm until a big imperial boot steps on him.
No one but a Tleilaxu may set foot in Bandalong, holiest city of the Bene Tleilax, for it is fanatically guarded, hallowed ground, purified by their god. Diplomacy in the Imperium, a Landsraad publication.